vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The pushbacks, without consideration of a migrant's individual circumstances and without any possibility of applying for asylum, are illegal under international human rights law. Greece has denied it uses such methods, claiming it is complying with European and international law and protecting the borders of the European Union. Its migration and asylum minister, Notis Mitsotakis, said it was Turkey's responsibility to eliminate smuggling routes and protect human life at sea by preventing unseaworthy boats to leave Turkish soil. Turkey signed a deal with the European Union in 2016 to stop migrants and refugees crossing into Greece, but said this year it could no longer enforce it. It is not just Greece in the eye of the storm, but also the EU's border agency, Frontex, which assists Greece in guarding the bloc's maritime borders. It has now been accused of helping, or turning a blind eye to, pushbacks in the Aegean Sea, and the latest charges have sparked one of the biggest crises since its creation. We're prepared for you an article written by Kostas Kalergis. The piece is titled, Migrants Accuse Greece of Sending Them Back Out to Sea. Please stay with us for more of Kostas Kalergis' article. In the early hours of Sunday, 29th of November, 16-year-old teenager Jinsi Kimbenga tried to reach Europe for a third time. He was on one of three dinghies that landed on the Greek island of Lesbos that day from Turkey. On that occasion, as with his two previous attempts, Jinsi says he was forcibly returned to Turkish waters. The pushbacks, without consideration of a migrant's individual circumstances and without any possibility of applying for political asylum, are illegal under international human rights law. Greece has denied it uses such methods, claiming it is complying with European and international law and protecting the borders of the European Union. During this third attempt to get to the European Union, Jinsi Kimbenga, who is originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo, documented part of his journey in the hope that the evidence of him being on Greek soil would prevent him being sent back to Turkey. It was still dark when the three boats landed on the southeast tip of the island of Lesbos, known as Katigos, on 29th of November. The new arrivals gathered in a forest nearby and waited for dawn, sending photographs and their GPS location to Aegean Boat Report, a Norwegian non-governmental organization that monitors migrants' flows in the sea. Hours later, local academic Kostas Theodorou was cycling with his wife in the area when they ran into two women who claimed they were migrants who had just arrived on the island just a few hours earlier. The women said they were both Christians, pregnant, and had not eaten for 3 days. Theodorou, an assistant professor at the University of the Aegean, said, "They said they wanted to go to hospital or the migrant camp. My wife left to get some cash so that we can put them in a taxi. But when he suggested calling the police, the women feared their passage to Europe would come to an abrupt end." The migrant groups then left the forest and headed north, taking further photographs of the places they passed. Aegean Boat Report published their whereabouts on Facebook and contacted Greek authorities. Jinsi Kimbenga and the others were met by a team of Hellenic Coast Guard officers and put on a bus. They were told they would be taken to a special camp for quarantine because of the COVID-19 pandemic. At least two Coast Guard number plates and one officer are visible in the footage the local television station has acquired from the scene. Jinsi Kimbenga says what followed deeply traumatized him. The bus drove for a couple of hours to the north of the island and stopped at a small port where men in balaclavas were waiting. The teenager recorded a video of on his mobile phone inside the bus. He's heard saying, "They dressed up like ninjas. They want to make us get on a boat and send us back to Turkey." The teenage boy says that the Greek officers then took everyone's phone, beat them heavily, and forced them on a big Coast Guard boat with something like a cannon in the front side that took them out to sea. He said they were forced into life rafts and were left to drift towards Turkish territorial waters. It is not clear why, but only two of the three groups that arrived in the island of Lesbos that Sunday morning, 29th of November, were sent back. Just hours later, at 2:40 a.m. in the early hours of the morning of 30th of November, the Turkish Coast Guard picked up 13 migrants from a life raft off Cape Kadirga to the north of the island of Lesbos. The woman in the red shirt who met Kostas Theodorou and his wife can be seen getting off the boat in a photograph released by the Turkish Coast Guard. Jinsi Kademba says he too was on that boat. Less than 3 hours later, a second raft with 18 migrants was rescued in the same area. A man with a fluorescent print on his shirt, who was pictured in the forest in Lesbos the previous morning, is seen leaving the Turkish Coast Guard boat. Dozens of similar incidents have been reported in recent months, and non-governmental organization Aegean Boat Report says that since the start of the year, Greek authorities have carried out close to 300 pushbacks. Turkey charges its neighbor of adopting the practice too. However, Greece claims it does not participate in so-called pushbacks, and Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis has condemned the allegations as an insult to the Hellenic Coast Guard. Instead, the Greek Prime Minister blames Turkey. Migration and Asylum Minister Notis Mitarachi says it was Turkey's responsibility to eliminate smuggling routes and protect human life at sea by preventing unseaworthy boats to leave Turkish coastline. Turkey signed a deal with the European Union in 2016 to stop migrants and refugees crossing into Greece, but said this year it could no longer enforce it. It is not just Greece in the eye of the storm, but also the EU's border agency, Frontex, which assists Greece in guarding the bloc's maritime borders. It has now been accused of helping or turning a blind eye to pushbacks in the Aegean Sea, and the latest charges have sparked one of the biggest crises since the creation of the EU border agency Frontex. Only last month, at a Frontex meeting on pushbacks, the Swedish representative presented evidence of Swedish officers witnessing a pushback off the island of Chios. An internal Frontex report describes several serious incident reports listing suspected irregularities or rights violations. One of the most detailed accounts, labeled Serious Incident Report 11095, /Stroke 2020 tells of an incident that took place in the night of April 19th, 2020. It says a Frontex plane witnessed a pushback and that Greek authorities urged Frontex to fly elsewhere. The head of Frontex, Fabrice Leggeri, grilled by members of the European Union Parliament's Civil Liberties Committee at the end of November, claimed no evidence had been found of active, direct or indirect Frontex involvement in the pushbacks. He added only the host member state, Greece, could decide what had to be done. Some members of the European Parliament supported the work of Frontex, but one group, the Socialists and Democrats, called for Leggeri's resignation. Dutch Green left MEP Tineke Streek said, "Leggeri is not credible anymore. She wants an inquiry committee to investigate human rights violations at the external border." The European Agency for Fundamental Rights has also accused Greece of carrying out pushbacks at its land border with Turkey. In an October 2020 report, it cited incidents on the Evros River in 2018, as well as allegations of physical ill treatment by police officers, border guards, or paramilitary groups. Meanwhile, the government in Athens has praised the work of its coast guard and highlighted the 80% reduction of migrant arrivals this year. It has struggled to cope with the thousands of migrants and refugees who have made it to the island of Lesbos. Jinsi Kimbenga, now a 17-year-old teenager, is for the moment in Istanbul, Turkey, and trying to find a place to stay for the winter. Kimbenga said, "But I'll try to go to Europe again when I feel better and if God permits it."
On Thursday, Morocco joined the list of Arab nations that normalized relations with Israel. The U.S. President Donald Trump announced the news on his Twitter page. He said the two sides decided to start full diplomatic relations. Morocco was among those countries that never had official ties with Israel since its occupation of Palestine in 1948. But in unofficial levels, the two sides have always shared relations and intelligence. In 1993, after Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization signed the Oslo Accord, Rabat and Tel Aviv began a series of low-level ties. But Morocco suspended the relations after the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada in the year 2000. That is why Rabat now called the normalization deal a resumption of diplomatic relations. Several reports by Moroccan media indicate that King Mohammed VI has sought to restore ties with Israel in recent years. But the government has denied or remained silent about such news.
The normalization between Israel and all the Arab and Muslim countries is really nothing new, at the exception of that this normalization is coming out to light. All these countries have never declared war on Israel and enjoyed excellent ties with the Israelis. Therefore, the only difference today is just this relationship is overt. So we're learning about it, about the exchange of diplomatic and normalization between Israel and these countries. It's just a mere propaganda and an advertisement for Netanyahu to boost his image domestically because of his domestic troubles at home.
Morocco agreed to this rapprochement in return for American recognition of the kingdom's claim over the long disputed territory of the Western Sahara region. In February, Israeli media reported that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had lobbied the U.S. to recognize Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara in exchange for the deal. Such a move gave Morocco what it has for long wanted, but it also undercuts an independent movement in the Western Sahara region, which has rejected Morocco's claims of sovereignty. The Polisario Front, an independent movement from Western Sahara, slammed the U.S. move and said it highly regrets Trump's decision. But the people of Western Sahara are not the only ones who are angry at the U.S. and Morocco. Palestinians have denounced the agreement also. The Palestine Liberation Organization said Morocco's decision was unacceptable. The resistance movement Hamas said that Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. Morocco's royal court said that King Mohammed VI had called Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and reiterated his commitment to the rights of Palestinians to have their own state. But it seems that Palestine has a hard time to believe the king. Behind the news that Israel and Morocco will establish the first formal diplomatic relationship, there lies almost six decades of close, secret cooperation on intelligence and military matters. Israel has helped Morocco obtain weapons and intelligence gathering gear and learn how to use them. Tel Aviv also helped Rabat to assassinate an opposition leader. In return, Morocco has helped Israel in matters like spying on other Arab countries. The two sides have had no problems contacting each other. The only thing they needed was a broker. The U.S. made that deal happen, and in the meantime, struck a deal for itself. Following the announcement, the administration of Trump has moved forward with a major arms sale to Morocco. The package is worth $1 billion and includes drones and precision-guided weapons. The White House has reportedly sent a notice to Congress about the potential deal.
We saw with the United Arab Emirates that the Americans promised to sell the F-35 and still didn't manage to get this deal off because the Israelis are blocking it and imposing specific conditions to keep the superiority over any other country. Therefore, with the Morocco wants some armed drone. Actually, it could have bought these armed drones from Turkey, and Turkey is supplying European countries and the international market with its most advanced drone, particularly after the last battle that its drone went through in Azerbaijan-Armenian conflict. I don't think it is the sale of arms that is attracting Morocco. I think it's a pressure from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who wants to gather as many countries, Islamic and Arab countries as possible, before he moves in and for Saudi Arabia to announce its official normalization with Israel.
This would be among the first drone sales under the Trump administration. Morocco is the latest country to agree to normalize relations with Israel and strike a deal with the U.S. as well. First, it was the UAE. The country announced its decision to establish diplomatic ties with Israel in August. In return, Washington provided Abu Dhabi with F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain and Sudan followed suit, with Sudan being removed from the U.S. blacklist of terrorism sponsor countries. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner said a similar deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia could happen soon. For now, it's unclear what the U.S. will give to Riyadh in return for striking a deal with Tel Aviv.
There's a certain set of rules when it comes to the act of war, setting out what can and cannot be done during an armed conflict. And should that law be breached, then the International Criminal Court, or ICC, is tasked with investigating and bringing guilty parties to justice. Yet it seems the court is losing its credibility, as the ICC has recently announced that it intends to abandon its inquiry into British war crimes during the Iraq War, leaving the victims of British atrocities in the country equally abandoned as they seek justice against the British military. However, in spite of the case being dropped, the prosecutor behind the investigation, Fatou Bensouda, has been left in no doubt that the British military committed no end of crimes while stationed in Iraq, leaving many questioning why the ICC would suddenly drop the case.
But obviously because Britain is one of the permanent five members of the Security Council. And on political grounds, Britain has actually been fairly supportive of the International Criminal Court, even when its close ally and boss, in fact, the US, has fought against it. The British have stood by it, and they've been fairly consistent on it.
So what then are the allegations against the British? Crimes that have said to have been committed include willful killing of innocent civilians, torture of prisoners of war, inhumane and cruel treatment, and rape, all of which are highly illegal under the international rules of conflict, and hence constitute as war crimes. The decision by the ICC to drop the case is being blamed on the lack of evidence submitted by the British military, raising the question from Human Rights Watch as to why the UK government has repeatedly shown little interest in investigating the crimes committed by its army. However, the British are no strangers to turning a blind eye to their crimes, as demonstrated through their brutal occupation of states during their imperial days, with the British also having been involved in conflicts in Afghanistan, the north of Ireland, and elsewhere. It remains to be seen as to whether the war crimes seen in Iraq have not been emulated elsewhere, and much like these, left to be forgotten in the past, just like the victims who were subjected to the British crimes. With more and more allegations coming to light of crimes being committed during conflict, from the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by the US and British, to the recent allegations that Australian Special Forces were involved in the killing of innocent civilians in order to pass initiation tests, it just goes to show how deep the problem really lies. Currently, the World War Crimes Court is also heavily involved in the investigation of US crimes committed during conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yet could the investigation into such crimes be suddenly dropped by the ICC should the US military refuse to cooperate? There does, however, lie a problem in the authority of the ICC, namely, that the US has stated that it just does not recognise the court, with the US President Donald Trump stating that the ICC has no jurisdiction over them, something that's been echoed by the Israeli regime, who, much like the US, UK and Australia, are guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Yet with the UK failing to assist the ICC in its investigation, nor having even brought one single prosecution against any of its personnel, how then can the ICC execute justice with no parties interested in cooperating with them or even acknowledging its authority?
Well, it isn't really. By the way, I think that the British have actually prosecuted the military for various crimes over the years. Not enough of them. I mean, they've committed many of them over the centuries, you know, whether it was in India or Kenya or, you know, even more recently. But they have prosecuted some. In Northern Ireland, they were prosecuting people. But in this case, they've investigated and they've... But I'm not trying to make excuses for them, but from their point of view, they could say that they didn't have enough evidence to meet the burden of a prosecution.
Should the ICC continue to be ignored or see its authority blanked, the question that remains to be asked is whether the body has lost all credibility, and if so, how can the rest of the international community allow the US and its allies to undermine such international bodies as and when it suits them?
Large gaps, a looming deadline, and still no appetite for any compromise. The European Union and Britain are digging their heels in, sending jitters throughout Europe. Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson arrived in Brussels on Wednesday and sat down for tense talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen 3 weeks before the Brexit transition period ends. The two failed to break the logjams in the talks. The only thing the two sides agreed on was perhaps to continue the talks at least through Sunday. The negotiations are tough and stressful because so much is at stake. UK and EU positions remain far apart over access to fishing waters, rules about stabilizing businesses, and how any new deal will be enforced and policed.
Britain controls a tremendous amount of sovereign territory in the sea, and that was basically ceded to Brussels to decide what's done with that back in 1973. So that, I think, is going to be the big sticking point. You know, the traditionally large area of sea around Britain, including out into the Atlantic, which Britain has controlled, has been extremely bountiful, particularly for the French fishermen who've been fishing those seas. And so I think possibly the fishing rights are going to be the biggest sticking point.
The UK Premier admitted after his talks in Brussels that there was, quote, a strong possibility that Britain and the EU would fail to hammer out a free trade agreement at the end of the year. The disappointing outcome of the talks in Brussels triggered the EU to publish contingency plans for the split in trading ties. Observers believe the publication of the EU contingency plans at this point shows that the Europeans are seriously preparing for a possible no-deal Brexit. The European bloc says it intends to avoid immediate chaos at the beginning of January.
The publication of contingency plans by Brussels is actually quite useful, but this is the sort of thing that should have been published, I think, years ago. So it was laid out clearly for the public and for businesses, the sort of thing that may happen if there was no deal.
Long-running negotiations on a trade deal with Britain seem to be reaching a make-or-break moment. But the EU member states insist that despite the looming deadline, they will not be forced into a bad deal. Some European leaders have been loud in rejecting any unsatisfactory agreement. French President Emmanuel Macron has been particularly outspoken. He has insisted that UK firms can expect preferential access to Europe's single market only if they obey its rules. France is worried that the British side is pushing for a deal that could give UK companies an unfair competitive advantage in the European market. The French government has warned that France could veto a bad deal, accusing London of seeking to divide the EU to get better terms. France's demands and concerns are widely shared by other EU member states. European diplomats say all countries in the European Union are serious about defending their collective interests.
The European Union and Brussels do not want to give Britain a deal which any other state in the EU will look at and think that's something we could do with and we would like. So on that level, they want to give Britain a bad deal.
Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has shown little sign of flexibility. Is he bluffing, or does he really believe the UK can easily weather the storm even if it leaves the bloc without a deal? An economically damaging divorce would undoubtedly hurt both sides. But observers warn that the UK would be impacted much more severely than the EU in case of a no-deal departure.
It's one of the world's worst-kept secrets, but evidence pointing to the involvement of the Saudi regime into the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has been kept hidden from the public domain based on intelligence service requests. However, for the first time since the assassination of the journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, a US judge has ordered the partial disclosure of any evidence held by the US intelligence agencies to be delivered to a New York court within a fortnight. It's most likely that the judge in question, Paul Engelmeyer, is referring to a list of exhibits linked to the murder, and in particular to a tape recording of the incident in which the sound of Khashoggi and the perpetrators of the crime can be heard. Already, the CIA have concluded that the murder was approved by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, although not actually present at the time of the killing, but was more than likely the one who ordered and oversaw the operation taking place.
What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged and therefore is requiring further investigation, in particular of the Crown Prince, for a variety of reasons. The first one is that the people directly implicated in the murder reported to him. So there is a reporting line here that needs to be further investigated.
With the court taking such a step, it could be the first phase in ousting those truly responsible for the murder, and more importantly, removing a cloak of immunity that Bin Salman, for one, is happy to hide behind, hence finally demanding some notion of accountability.
It's a state killing, and as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable. So far, there has been no move on the part of the international community to treat the execution of Mr. Khashoggi as something that was sponsored, incited, ordered by the state.
What now remains to be seen is whether the likes of the CIA and other agencies in the US will obey the court order, or will they too hide behind the veil of national security interests in order to protect the likes of Bin Salman from finally being brought to justice. It seems that the young and inexperienced Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has allowed the power to go to his head, already forging a negative reputation for himself, as demonstrated in his range of recklessly backed actions since taking the position of Crown Prince. Yet could his actions now be coming back to haunt him? With the order by the US court to expose the tapes surrounding the murder, could the heavily cash-influenced and petrodollar relationship between the US and the Saudi regime be turning sour? Bin Salman's also been accused of sending a murder hit squad to Canada to assassinate former Saudi intelligence official Saad al-Jabri, something that Bin Salman strongly denies, yet all the evidence points towards the favoured modus operandi of the Crown Prince following the foiling of the plot by the Canadian security services. There's also speculation that Bin Salman met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a secret meeting just prior to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. However, the meeting has been denied, yet somehow suggests that Bin Salman was aware and briefed about the Israeli regime plot to murder on Iranian soil. But there's a saving grace for Bin Salman, namely the protection he enjoys from the current US President, Donald Trump. Following the murder of Khashoggi, Trump was happy to turn a blind eye to the event, likely dazed by the wads of cash flowing in from Saudi Arabia to the US through arms deals and more.
We also have a great ally in Saudi Arabia. They give us a lot of jobs, they give us a lot of business, a lot of economic development.
What now remains to be seen is whether the president-elect, Joe Biden, will be as accommodating towards Bin Salman as his predecessor, and if not, will Bin Salman survive without Uncle Donald by his side?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says in opening remarks to a climate summit, world leaders should declare states of climate emergency in their countries to spur action to avoid catastrophic global warming. More than 70 world leaders addressed a one-day virtual gathering aimed at building momentum for much steeper cuts in planet warming carbon dioxide emissions on the fifth anniversary of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said via video conference on Saturday, 12th of December, "Can anybody still deny that we're facing a dramatic emergency? That is why today I call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached." Guterres said economic recovery packages launched in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic represented an opportunity to accelerate the transition to a low-carbon future, but warned this was not happening fast enough. We now present you an article written by Andrea Kutieru under the heading, "What 2020 Meant for Climate Change and the Environment." The article has been taken from the front page of the archdaily.com website. Please stay with us for more of Andrea Kutieru's article. First lockdown brought most of the world to a standstill, and many were quick to point out the silver lining, the significant drop in carbon dioxide emissions. However, this pollution reduction was short-lived, and past crises indicate that we might be standing at a crossroads when it comes to our climate goals. What has this unprecedented year meant for the efforts to curb climate change and protect the environment? As most economic activities have slowed down this year, especially in spring, a significant drop in greenhouse gas emissions was expected. According to the latest data, after several months of lockdown, severely reduced air traffic and closed construction sites, carbon emissions this year have only gone down 5.5% from 2019 levels. This not only illustrates how the pandemic's impact on climate change was overstated, but it paints an entirely new picture of the scale and effort required to shift the needle in terms of carbon emissions. As the pandemic unfolded, climate disruption continued apace. 2020 is on track to be one of the three warmest years on record, completing a streak of six consecutive years, each one hotter than the other. The year was also marked by extreme weather events, from the devastating bushfires in Australia and floods in Asia and the United States to severe droughts in South America, all consequences of climate change. The coronavirus pandemic has created a surge in plastic waste, adding to the already dire pollution problem. Naturally, this year's main priority has been mitigating the virus spread by implementing collaborative protective measures. However, the latter generated large quantities of waste, from disposable face masks and other personal protective equipment to increased use of acrylic screens, together with other single-use plastic items. For now, the technology for recycling acrylic screens is expensive and may generate harmful byproducts, and the personal protective equipment used in medical facilities is largely non-recyclable. 2020 has therefore meant a setback in the fight against plastic pollution, with negative consequences for wildlife. Challenging times usually spearhead structural changes. And that was the case with the 70s oil crisis, which marked a decrease in oil reliance and a shift towards natural gas, resulting in a drop in carbon emissions. Natural gas emits 50% to 60% less carbon dioxide than coal or oil. However, the 2008 financial crisis has failed to shift the global economy towards a carbon emission decrease. On the contrary, with countries struggling to recover, carbon dioxide emissions increased, especially in emerging economies, reaching an all-time high in 2010. As governments around the world are currently rolling out bailout policies attempting to save jobs, sustainability agendas might be easily and understandably sidetracked. Moreover, leading oil and gas companies around the world are taking advantage of the situation to demand government bailouts and the ease of environmental regulations, setting back the fight against climate change. Many academics and scholars and environmental scientists see this pandemic as an opportunity to redirect our industries. The aviation sector is already taking steps towards a more sustainable future, with Airbus announcing its so-called plan to have a hydrogen-powered commercial aircraft in service by 2035. However, transportation accounts for 14% of global emissions. In comparison, the architecture, engineering and construction (AEC) industry is responsible for a staggering 39% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Hence, the latter must make great strides in years to come and act with a sense of urgency. The production of steel and concrete, the two most common construction materials, generates 10% of the world's annual greenhouse gases. Therefore, there is a strong imperative to shift towards sustainable alternatives. Also, adaptive reuse, material recycling, and design for disassembly need to become standard practices, as is essential for architecture and the construction sector to embrace innovation quickly and programmatically. As of now, the current pandemic has mostly prompted architects to question spatial typologies. Still, it should also have put the industry's relationship with the environment into sharper focus. This year, the profession continued its attempts to fully commit to a standard set of principles and goals regarding climate change. However, as well-intended professional initiatives like architects declare might be, they are only as strong as the members' commitment. In this very case, the project's scope might be hindered by the recent withdrawal of the two largest members of the network, Zaha Hadid Architects and Foster and Partners, due to differences regarding specific architectural programs problematic to the fight against climate change. It goes to show that for effective change to happen, the profession needs policies and building codes mandating sustainable design principles. The architecture, engineering, and construction industry can bring a significant contribution to curbing climate change in the following years, as scientists point to growing evidence that the same activities that contribute to climate change enable the emergence of new diseases. It's time for the industry to consider sustainable design, not as the right thing to do, but as the only option. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says in opening remarks to a climate summit, world leaders should declare states of climate emergency in their countries to spur action to avoid catastrophic global warming. More than 70 world leaders addressed a one-day virtual gathering aimed at building momentum for much steeper cuts in planet warming carbon dioxide emissions on the fifth anniversary of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Antonio Guterres said via video conference on Saturday, 12th of December, "Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency? That is why today I call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached." Guterres said economic recovery packages launched in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic represented an opportunity to accelerate the transition to a low-carbon future, but warned this was not happening fast enough. Guterres also noted, "So far, the members of the G20 are spending 50% more in their stimulus packages and rescue packages on sectors linked to fossil fuel production and consumption than on low-carbon energy." He said, "This is unacceptable. The trillions of dollars needed for COVID-19 recovery is money that we are borrowing from future generations," he added. "We cannot use these resources to lock in policies that burden future generations with a mountain of debt on a broken planet." On Friday, 11th of December, summit co-host Britain announced it would pledge an end to direct government support for overseas fossil fuel projects at the summit, aiming to spur similar moves by other countries to accelerate a shift to cleaner energy. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson told the summit that countries could work together to radically cut dependence on fossil fuels, change agricultural practices, and reverse the process by which for centuries humanity has been quilting the planet in a toxic tea cozy of greenhouse gases. Boris Johnson said, "At the same time, we can create hundreds of thousands of jobs, millions of jobs in fact, across the planet as we collectively recover from coronavirus." Diplomats were watching summit speeches for any sign of significantly stronger climate pledges from countries including the United States, China, India, and Japan.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن
Allah
هو ذا المنان
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from series of Q&A and Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. If you have been following this series of sessions and shows, we have been talking about different questions and misconceptions concerning some Islamic issues, and the respected guest speakers and guests of this show will try to provide us with some answers. Today, again, like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, researcher from Qom Seminary Schools, to answer the questions that we pose in this session. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day is concerning violence and specifically the domestic violence. So what does Islam say concerning domestic violence? Because in some cases, those who want to distort the beautiful image of Islam, they sometimes refer to these domestic violences that can be uttered by some Muslims or followers of the religion of Islam. We wanted to see and ask an Islamic scholar to know about exactly, to know about the viewpoint of Islam with regard to domestic violence. Is Islam okay with that? And if yes, to what extent Islam is okay with domestic violence? We'd be thankful if you give us some good explanation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the short answer is Islam rejects violence and domestic violence altogether, period. There is no doubt about this. But talking about this issue in details, we see that Quran, the Noble Book of Quran, with regard to the domestic violence, talks about different factors and elements and reasons for it, and to give us some solutions to be away from domestic violence. For example, according to the Noble Book of Quran, one of the reasons for violence is jealousy. The first example could be the jealousy of Qabil or Cabel regarding his brother Habil or Abel. We know that Habil was killed by Qabil out of jealousy. Mm-hmm. And the other case would be the story of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam. We know that his brothers made a violence against him because of their jealousy.
True.
The other factor and element which is very important is the false beliefs of the people. Islam and the Noble Book of Quran talk about this issue in many verses to remove such false viewpoints and beliefs of the people which cause violence and domestic violence. For example, the violence of the Bedouin Arabs against the women and against their newborn daughters, and also exchanging their daughters and women, marrying their stepmother, and forcing their women to, give them back their dowries. We see that in all these cases, Islam mentions these false beliefs in the Noble Book of Quran and invite the people to be away from these wrong beliefs. We have serious instructions in the Noble Book of Quran regarding these issues. For example, in chapter An-Nisa, verse 19, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, O you who have faith, it is not lawful for you to inherit women forcibly. This was something practiced by the Arabs in the time of the Jahiliyyah or ignorance. And do not press them to take away part of what you have given them. It was also a practice among the Arabs. They used to force the women to forget about their dowries, mm-hmm. and give them back. Instead, Islam brought the concept of the inheritance of women. Before that, there was no issue of the inheritance of women among the Arabs. We see in chapter An-Nisa, verse 7, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لِلْرِجَالِ نَسِيبٌ مِمَّا تَرَكَ الْوَالِدَانِ وَالْأَقْرَبُ مِمَّا تَرَكَ الْوَالِدَانِ وَالْأَقْرَبُونَ وَلِلْنِسَاءِ نَسِيبٌ مِمَّا تَرَكَ الْوَالِدَانِ وَالْأَقْرَبُونَ. So, for both men and women, there is a share in the inheritance. So we see these cases in the Noble Book of Quran. The wrong beliefs and traditions of the Arabs are mentioned, and Islam rejects them and brings about a new instructions to remove these wrong beliefs, which in many cases cause domestic violence. Yes. The other reason was the economical problems. Poverty in many cases is the reason for domestic violence. Also among the Arabs, again at the time of the Jahiliyya, the ignorance, in some cases they used to kill their children out of poverty. So this is the greatest example of domestic violence, to kill your child because of poverty. Islam prohibited that with a very serious tone. Chapter Al-Isra, verse 31, وَلَا تَقْتُلُوا أَوْلَادَكُمْ خَشْيَةَ إِمْلَاقٍ. You should not kill your children out of fearing of poverty. نَحْنُ نَرْزُقُهُمْ وَإِيَّاكُمْ. We, that is God, we give them the sustenance, and also we give you the sustenance. It also has been mentioned in chapter An'am, verse 151. So this is the first aspect. Islam mentions, and the Noble Book of Quran mentions the causes, some of the causes of domestic violence, and tries to explain to people how to get rid of these problems.
Sheikh, it's true that you actually mentioned these some factors as the causes of the domestic violence, but how can poverty, economy, and dowry of the family be the cause of violence? Do you mean that, for example, in case that a lady is asking for her dowry, this will end to a sort of quarrel between men and women? This is the reason that you are talking about? The but in case Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually issued something as a rule between the members of the family, and this will end and will cause violence, so shouldn't we think on the source and origin of the one who actually issued such a rule?
You know, I mentioned three reasons. One was that jealousy. Jealousy is a reason for violence sometimes.
Yeah.
I mentioned the example of Yusuf. Regarding him, his brother made a domestic violence.
But that's true that this this action of Abel led to that sort of violence. But I want to say that jealousy is not going to end in violence in any case, right? In one case, in a specific case, it led to violence. In even another case, it might lead to violence as well. But is it something prevalent that we can judge on it?
My point is that Islam mentions some of the causes of violence and asks the people to be away from them. Jealousy is one of them. Wrong beliefs is one of them. Economical problems are among them. So the Noble Book of Quran refers to the causes, at least some of the causes of domestic violence, to instruct the people. I'm not going to say that, yes, I mean, jealousy in all the cases leads to domestic violence. No. We are, taking into consideration different reasons and causes for domestic violence.
But we focus on three of them.
Yeah.
That's it.
These are the, among the causes mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran. So my first point was that, because the question is about Islam and domestic violence, we said that first of all, the Quran mentions some of the causes for domestic violence and asks the people to be away from these causes and factors.
Thank you very much.
Now, the next point, the next aspect is the solution of Islam to prevent from domestic violence. One of them is controlling people's anger. We have different instructions in the Quran and in the narration. We know that anger is one of the main reasons which caused violence in general and domestic violence in specific. There are many verses and narrations. It is in need of a separate discussion. So Islam instructs Muslims how to get rid of their anger. The second point is that Islam educates Muslims and all the peoples about the true and proper relationships in the family. be it between wife and husband, or parents and children, brothers and sisters, and so on and so forth. Specifically, when it comes to women, the ladies, the wives, Islam again has serious instructions to the men.
Mm-hmm.
So through instructing proper relationship between men and women, Islam tries to help men get rid of domestic violence. In chapter An-Nisa, verse 19, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَعَاشِرُوهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ. You have to treat your wives بِالْمَعْرُوفِ, in an honorable manner.
True.
And should you dislike them, maybe you dislike something, while Allah invests it with an abundant good. This is very interesting. Again, sometimes we can think of domestic violence to be practiced by men who dislike their women.
Mm-hmm.
They do not love their wives, they maybe hate them.
True.
But here Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that even فَإِن كَرِهْتُمُهُنَّ, even if you hate your wives, you hate the ladies, you should be patient, because sometimes you hate something, but your goodness is in that. Asa أَن تَكْرَهُ شَيْئًا, you may hate something, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put goodness in it. Also, we have some narrations, very interesting narration in this regard. For example, the Prophet says that if you have a bad wife, a bad-tempered wife, and you are patient over her bad-temperedness, then you will have so many rewards. For example, it is as if you have worshipped Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala the whole day and the whole night. So the second point was that Islam tries to instruct the men the proper relationship between men and women.
Very true.
The next issue is that Islam tries to reform the attitude of men toward women. I talked about some of the wrong beliefs at the time of Jahiliyyah or ignorance, but Islam came to reform the viewpoint and the attitude of men when it comes to women, regarding women. So, for example, according to Islam, when it comes to creation, there is no difference between men and women. There are many narrations regarding mothers, how, great is the value of mothers. And in some narrations, men are very seriously prevented from harming their wives, let alone, wounding or, beating, hitting, and so on and so forth. In one very famous narration, the Holy Prophet has compared women to Rayhana, a very good smelling flower that should not be bothered at all.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and some Islamic advices on how to lessen the amount of domestic violence in family, and what ways that Islam suggests in order to lessen the domestic violence. Let's continue the discussion, inshallah, in the upcoming session. And other questions that needs to be asked around this issue, inshallah, we shall pose them in the next session. Dear brothers and sisters, many thanks for staying tuned. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
IRIB English Radio.